In this lecture, I offer a Christian critique of 9/11 in the light of the American Empire, and a critique of the American Empire in the light of 9/11. Such a critique, of course, presupposes an understanding of 9/11 itself, particularly who was responsible for the attacks. The official theory is that the attacks were carried out entirely by Arab Muslims. The main alternative theory is that 9/11 was a false flag operation orchestrated by forces within our own government who made it appear to be the work of Arab Muslims. Originally, a false flag attack was one in which the attackers, perhaps in ships, literally showed the flag of an enemy country in order to have it blamed. But now the expression has come to be used for any attack that is made to be appear to be the work of some group or country other than that to which the attackers themselves belong. I will argue that the attacks of 9/11 were false flag attacks orchestrated to marshal support for a war against Muslim and Arab states as the next stage in creating a global Pax Americana, an all-inclusive global empire. I will conclude this lecture with its main question. How should Christians in America respond to the realization that we are living in an empire similar to the Roman Empire at the time of Jesus, which put him to death for resistance against it? The evidence that 9/11 was a false flag operation is very strong. Most Americans, however, reject this idea on a priori grounds, thereby refusing even to consider the evidence. The main a priori assumption is that America's political and military leaders simply would not carry out such a heinous act. But this assumption is undermined once we know something about the history of false flag operations. Far from being rare in the history of warfare, such operations are very common. They have been especially popular with empires wanting to expand their empires. In 1931, Japan, which had been exploiting Manchuria for its resources, decided to take over the whole province. To have a pretext, the Japanese army blew up the tracks of its own railway near the Chinese military base of Mukden, then blamed the sabotage on Chinese soldiers. This Mukden incident occurred on September 18, 1931. The Chinese call it 9/18. A year and a half later, the Nazis, less than a month after taking power, started a fire in the German Reichstag, then blamed it on communists. The proof that the communists were responsible was the discovery of a feeble-minded left-wing radical at the site who had been brought to the site by the Nazis themselves. They then used the Reichstag fire as a pretext to arrest thousands of communists and social democrats, to shut down all unfriendly newspapers, and to annul civil rights. That was 1933. 6 years later, Hitler wanted a pretext to attack Poland. The solution, known as Operation Himmler, was to have Germans dressed as Poles stage 21 raids on the Polish-German border. In some cases, as in the raid on the Gliwice radio station, a dead German convict was dressed as a Pole and left at the scene. The next day, Hitler, referring to these 21 border incidents, presented the attack on Poland as a defensive necessity. More germane to the question of 9/11, of course, is whether American leaders would do such things. In 1846, President James Polk, anxious to expand the American Empire, had the U.S. Army build a fort on the Rio Grande, some 150 miles south of the commonly accepted border between Texas and Mexico. After 16 U.S. soldiers were killed in a skirmish, Polk, very pleased, told Congress that Mexico had shed American blood upon American soil. This claim was called the sheerest deception by a congressman named Abraham Lincoln. Nevertheless, the Mexican-American War was on, and in 1848, Mexico, being outgunned, signed a peace treaty ceding away half of its country for a paltry sum. In 1898, the United States falsely accused Spain of blowing up a battleship, the USS Maine, that President McKinley had sent to Havana Harbor uninvited. This accusation, which led to the chant, "Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain," was used as a pretext to start the Spanish-American War, through which America took control of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. In the latter case, the United States, after helping the Filipinos defeat the Spanish, went to war against the Filipinos, claiming that they had fired on American soldiers. 250,000 Filipinos died in the resulting slaughter. Many years later, General Arthur MacArthur admitted that American troops had fired first to start a prearranged battle. In 1964, a false account of an incident in the Tonkin Gulf was used to start the full-scale Vietnam War. Of course, we might be tempted to reply, Americans have done such thing to enemy nations, but they would never deliberately kill citizens of friendly countries for political purposes. That assumption is undermined in a recent book by a Swiss historian named Daniel Ganser called NATO's Secret Armies. In this book, Ganser demonstrates that during the Cold War, the United States sponsored false flag operations in many countries of Western Europe, in order to discredit communists and other leftists, to prevent them from coming to power through elections. Italy suffered a deadly wave of terrorist attacks in the 1970s, including a massive explosion at the Bologna railway station that killed 85 people. Between 1983 and 85, Belgium suffered a series of terrorist attacks known as the Brabant Massacres, in which hooded men opened fire on people in shopping centers. There were 16 such attacks, which reduced Belgium to a state of panic. At the time, all these attacks were blamed on communists and other leftists, often by virtue of planted evidence. In the 1990s, however, it was discovered that the attacks were really carried out by right-wing organizations that were coordinated by a secret unit within NATO, which was guided by the CIA and the Pentagon. A former member of the organization that carried out the massacres in Belgium, which was funded by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, explained that the plan was to make the population believe that these terrorist attacks were done by the left. The former head of Italian counterintelligence, in explaining the motivation behind the attacks in Italy, said, "The CIA wanted to create an Italian nationalism capable of halting what it saw as a slide to the left. To achieve this goal," he added, "it seemed that the Americans would do anything." If Americans would do anything to achieve their political goals in Europe, would they do similar things in America itself? Early in 1962, which was shortly after Fidel Castro had overthrown the pro-American dictator Batista, the Joint Chiefs of Staff presented President Kennedy with a plan called Operation Northwoods. This plan described pretexts which would provide justification for U.S. military intervention in Cuba, partly by developing the international image of the Cuban government as rash and irresponsible and as an alarming and unpredictable threat to the peace of the Western Hemisphere. Possible actions to create this image included communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area and Washington, and a Remember the Maine incident in which we could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. Although President Kennedy did not approve this plan, it had been endorsed by all the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon. U.S. political and military leaders, as these examples show, have been fully capable of orchestrating false flag operations that would kill innocent people, including American citizens, to achieve political goals. The political goal during the Cold War was to prevent and overthrow left-leaning governments. But what motive could U.S. leaders have had for orchestrating the attacks of 9/11, a decade after the Cold War was over? Actually, it was precisely the end of the Cold War that provided the likely motive, the desire to create a global Pax Americana. Whereas the world during the Cold War was bipolar, the demise of the Soviet Union created in some minds, the minds of that group known as neoconservatives or neocons, the prospect of a unipolar world. In 1989, Charles Krauthammer published a piece entitled Universal Dominion, in which he argued that America should work for a qualitatively new outcome, a unipolar world. A year later, he said the United States, as the unchallenged superpower, should act unilaterally, unashamedly laying down the rules of world order and being prepared to enforce them. The most important neocon has been Dick Cheney. In 1992, the last year of his tenure as Secretary of Defense, he had two of his assistants, Paul Wolfowitz and Lewis Scudder Libby, write a draft of the Pentagon's defense planning guidance, which said America's first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival. Andrew Bacevich, who is a conservative but not a neoconservative, has called this draft a blueprint for permanent American global hegemony. An article in Harper's calls it an early version of Cheney's plan to rule the world. During the rest of the 1990s, while the Republicans were out of the White House, the unipolar dream kept growing. In 1996, Robert Kagan said the United States should use its military strength to maintain a world order which both supports and rests upon American hegemony. In the following year, William Kristol, the son of neocon godfather Irving Kristol, founded a unipolarist think tank called the Project for the New American Century, often called simply PNAC or PNAC. Its members included Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Libby, and many other neocons who became central members of the Bush-Cheney administration. In September of 2000, 3 months before they took office, PNAC published a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, reaffirming the basic tenets of the Cheney-Wolfowitz draft of 1992. This document said that America's grand strategy should aim to preserve and extend its present advantageous position, and thereby to preserve and enhance the American peace. What would it take, according to these neocons, to preserve and enhance the Pax Americana? Basically, five things. First, control of the world's oil. As Robert Dreyfus, a critic of the neocons, says, whoever controls oil controls the world. For the neocons, this meant bringing about regime change in several oil-rich countries, especially Iraq. Several neocons, including Cheney and Rumsfeld, had wanted the first President Bush to take out Saddam in 1990. They continued to advocate this policy throughout the 1990s, with PNAC even writing a letter to President Clinton in 1998, urging him to use military force to remove Saddam's regime from power. After the Bush-Cheney administration took office, attacking Iraq was the main item on the agenda. The only real question, reports former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, was finding a way to do it. A second necessary condition for the envisaged Pax Americana was a transformation of the military in light of the revolution in military affairs, made possible by information technology, computers. At the center of this transformation is the military use of space. The term missile defense implies that the use of space is to be purely defensive. But as one neocon, Lawrence Kaplan, has candidly stated, missile defense isn't really meant to protect America. It's a tool for global domination. In any case, implementing this transformation will be very expensive, which brings us to a third requirement, an increase in military spending. The end of the Cold War made this requirement challenging because most Americans assume that since we are no longer trying to contain global communism, we could drastically cut defense spending, thereby having a peace dividend to spend on health, education, and the environment. A fourth neocon requirement for a Pax Americana was a modification of the doctrine of preemptive attack. Traditionally, a country has had the right to launch a preemptive attack against another country if an attack from that country was imminent, too imminent to take the matter to the UN Security Council. But neocons wanted the United States to act to preclude threats that might arise in the more or less distant future. These four developments would require a fifth thing, an event that would make the American people ready to accept these imperialistic policies. This point had been made in The Grand Chessboard, a 1997 book by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. Brzezinski is not a neocon, but he shares their concern with American primacy in the world. Portraying Central Asia with its vast oil reserves as the key to world power, Brzezinski argued that America must get control of that region. But, he counseled, Americans, with their democratic instincts, are reluctant to authorize the military spending and the human sacrifices necessary for imperial mobilization. And this reluctance limits the use of America's power, especially its capacity for military intimidation. But this impediment could be overcome, he added, if there were a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. The American people, for example, were willing to enter World War II only after the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The same idea was suggested in PNAC's document of 2000. Referring to the goal of transforming the military, it said that this process of transformation is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. When the attacks of 9/11 occurred, they were treated like a new Pearl Harbor. President Bush reportedly wrote in his diary that night, "The Pearl Harbor of the 21st century occurred today." Many commentators, from Robert Kagan to Henry Kissinger to a writer for Time magazine, said that America should respond to the attacks of 9/11 in the same way that it had responded to the attack on Pearl Harbor. Rumsfeld said that 9/11 created the kind of opportunities that World War offered to refashion the world. Bush and Condoleezza Rice made similar comments, speaking of 9/11 as providing opportunities. And it did, in fact, create opportunities to fulfill what the neocons had listed as the necessary conditions of a Pax Americana. With regard to oil, the Bush administration had, during the summer of 2001, developed a plan to attack Afghanistan to replace the Taliban with a puppet regime, thereby allowing UNICOL to build its proposed pipeline from the Caspian Sea and the U.S. military to begin building bases in the region. The official story of 9/11, according to which it was carried out by members of al-Qaeda under the direction of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, provided the needed pretext for this operation. In 2004, Rumsfeld told the 9/11 Commission that prior to 9/11, the President could not have convinced Congress that the United States needed to invade Afghanistan and overthrow the Taliban. 9/11 also provided a necessary condition for the attack on Iraq. It did not provide a sufficient condition. The administration still had to wage a propaganda offensive to convince the public that Saddam was involved in 9/11, was connected to al-Qaeda, and illegally possessed weapons of mass destruction. But 9/11 was a necessary condition. As neocon Kenneth Edelman has said, at the beginning of the administration, people were talking about Iraq, but it wasn't doable. That changed with September 11. Stephen Snigowski, explaining why 9/11 made the attack on Iraq possible, says, "The 9/11 attacks made the American people angry and fearful. Ordinary Americans wanted to strike back at the terrorist enemy, even though they weren't sure exactly who the enemy was. Moreover, they were fearful of more attacks and were susceptible to the administration's propaganda that the United States had to strike Iraq before Iraq somehow struck the United States." New Pearl Harbor also opened the way for the revolution in military affairs. Prior to 9/11, Basevich reports, military transformation appeared to be dead in the water. But the so-called war on terror after 9/11 created an opening for advocates to make their case. 9/11 also allowed for great increases in military spending. Congress immediately appropriated an additional $40 billion for the Pentagon, and much more since. The new Pearl Harbor also paved the way for the new doctrine of preemptive warfare. The events of 9/11, observes Basevich, provided the tailor-made opportunity to break free of the fetters restricting the exercise of American power. Bush first alluded to this new doctrine at his West Point speech the following June. It was then fully articulated in the administration's 2002 version of the National Security Strategy, which said that America will act against emerging threats before they are fully formed. 9/11 provided, in fact, the tailor-made opportunity for realizing all the things that Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and other neocons had been dreaming about during the previous decade. Should not this fact lead us to suspect that 9/11 was not simply a godsend for them? In any criminal investigation, the first question is always cui bono, who benefits? Why should we not apply this principle to 9/11? Let us look at some evidence to see if it supports the view that 9/11 was a false flag operation orchestrated to produce precisely the benefits for the Bush-Cheney administration that it in fact did produce. The official account of 9/11, by blaming the attack on Arab Muslims, provided the pretext for the attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq. But there are many problems with this official account. For one thing, the alleged hijackers are portrayed as devout Muslims, ready to meet their maker. Muhammad Atta, called the ringleader, is said by the 9/11 Commission to have become religious, even fanatically so. But some journalists found that he loved cocaine, alcohol, gambling, pork, and lap dances. Several of the other alleged hijackers had similar tastes. Also, the flight manifests that have been released for the four flights have no Arab names on them. It appears, moreover, that evidence was planted. Authorities allegedly found two of Otto's bags, which supposedly arrived too late from Otto's commuter flight, to be put on Flight 11. These bags contained Otto's passport and his will, along with various types of incriminating evidence. But why would Otto have planned to take his will on a flight that he planned to head into the World Trade Center? There are also many problems in the official story about Osama bin Laden. In June of 2001, when he was already America's most wanted criminal, bin Laden reportedly spent 2 weeks in the American hospital in Dubai, where he was visited by the local CIA agent. Also, after 9/11, when America was supposedly trying to get bin Laden dead or alive, the U.S. military evidently allowed him to escape on at least four occasions, the last one being the Battle of Tora Bora, which the London Telegraph labeled a grand charade. Moreover, although the Bush administration promised that Secretary of State Colin Powell would provide a white paper with proof that the attacks had been planned by bin Laden, this paper was never produced. And although the Taliban said that it would hand bin Laden over if the United States simply provided some evidence of his involvement in 9/11, the Bush administration refused. Finally, although this administration claims that bin Laden admitted responsibility for the attacks in a video allegedly found in Afghanistan, the man in this video has darker skin, fuller cheeks, and a broader nose than the Osama bin Laden of all the other videos. We again seem to have planted evidence. Indeed, within the 9/11 truth movement, this video is widely known as the fake bin Laden video. Reasons to believe that 9/11 was a false flag operation are also provided by various features of the attacks that could not have been accomplished by the alleged hijackers. One of these is the destruction of the World Trade Center. According to the official explanation, the Twin Towers and Building 7 collapsed primarily from their fires, plus, in the case of the Twin Towers, the impact of the airplanes. But this explanation faces several formidable problems. First, many people have been led to believe from some early television shows that the steel in these steel frame buildings was melted by the fires. But steel does not melt until 2800 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas hydrocarbon fires and jet fuel, kerosene is a hydrocarbon, can at best get to 1700 degrees. Also, the fires in these three buildings were not very big, very hot, or very long-lasting, compared with fires in some steel frame high-rises that did not collapse. A fire in Philadelphia in 1991 burned 18 hours. A fire in Caracas in 2004 burned 17 hours, but neither of these buildings collapsed. By contrast, the North and South Towers burned only 102 minutes and 56 minutes, respectively, before they collapsed. Building 7, which was not hit by a plane, had fires on only a few floors, according to all the photographic evidence and several witnesses. The collapse of Building 7 has been recognized as especially difficult to explain. The FEMA report said that the most likely scenario it could come up with had only a low probability of occurrence. The collapse of Building 7 is not even mentioned in the 571 pages of the 9/11 Commission report, even though this collapse was, according to the official account, a historic event, the first time a steel frame high-rise building had ever collapsed from fire alone. The latest official report put out by the National Institute of Standards and Technology has claimed that the towers collapsed because the airplanes knocked the fireproofing off the steel. I'm not making this up. But it has yet to explain why Building 7, which was not hit by a plane, also collapsed. This leads us to a second major problem, which is that all total collapses of steel frame high-rise buildings, both before and after 9/11, have been brought about by explosives in the process known as controlled demolition. Third, the collapses of the Twin Towers and Building 7 all manifested many standard features of controlled demolition. Give seven examples. First, the collapses began suddenly, whereas steel, if it were gradually weakened by the fires, would gradually begin to sag. But if you look at the videos on the internet, which are available, you see that the buildings are completely stable, motionless, and then, and that's the next feature. The buildings collapse straight down instead of toppling over, which would have caused enormous death and destruction in Lower Manhattan. The straight down collapse is a feature of that type of controlled demolition known as implosion, which only a few companies in the world are able to orchestrate. Third, these buildings collapsed at virtually free fall speed, which means that the lower floors, with all their steel and concrete, were offering no resistance to the upper floors. Fourth, the collapses were total collapses, resulting in piles of rubble only a few stories high. This means that the enormous steel columns, 47 of them in the Twin Towers, in the core of each building, had to be broken into rather short pieces. And that's what explosives do. Fifth, great quantities of molten steel were produced, which means that the steel had to be heated up to several thousand degrees. Witnesses at the cleanup site reported, moreover, that sometimes when pieces of steel were lifted up, the ends were dripping molten metal. Sixth, firemen, medical workers, journalists, World Trade Center employees, police officers, and others have testified that explosions were going on, multiple explosions, before and during the collapses of the Twin Towers. For example, Fire Captain Dennis Tardil said, "I hear an explosion and I look up. It is as if the building is being imploded from the top down, one after another, boom, boom, boom." Another firefighter said, "It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. It seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt, all these explosions." One more feature of the collapses of the Twin Towers was that virtually everything except the steel, all the desks, the computers, the carpets, everything was pulverized into tiny dust particles. The official story cannot explain one, let alone all, of these seven features. At least, as physicist Stephen Jones has pointed out, without violating several laws of physics. But the theory of controlled demolition easily explains them all. The evidence for controlled demolition contradicts the idea that Al-Qaeda terrorists were responsible. They could not have obtained access to the buildings for all the hours that would have been needed to plant the explosives. Agents of the Bush-Cheney administration, by contrast, could have gotten such access, given the fact that Marvin Bush and Wirt Walker III, the president's brother and cousin, respectively, were principals of the company in charge of security for the World Trade Center. Also, Al-Qaeda terrorists probably would not have had the courtesy to ensure that the buildings came straight down rather than toppling over. Another relevant fact is that evidence was destroyed. An examination of the building's steel columns could have shown whether explosives had been used to slice them. But virtually all of the steel was quickly sold to scrap dealers, trucked away, and sent to Asia to be melted down. It is usually a federal crime to remove anything from a crime scene, even a matchbook. But this removal of thousands of tons of steel, the biggest destruction of evidence in history, was carried out under the supervision of federal officials. Evidence was also apparently planted. The passport of one of the hijackers on Flight 11 was allegedly found in the rubble. Having survived not only the fire, but whatever turned everything else in the North Tower into very fine dust, except the steel. The official account of the attack on the Pentagon is equally problematic. According to this account, the Pentagon was struck by American Airlines Flight 77 under the control of Al-Qaeda hijacker Hani Hanyur, but this claim is challenged by many facts. First, Flight 77 allegedly, after making a U-turn in the Midwest, flew back to Washington undetected for 40 minutes. And yet the U.S. military, which by then would have known that hijacked airliners were being used as weapons, has the best radar systems in the world, one of which, it brags, does not miss anything in American airspace. Second, the aircraft, in order to hit the West Wing, reportedly executed a 270-degree downward spiral, which some pilots have said would have been difficult, perhaps impossible, for a Boeing 77, even with an expert pilot. Hani Hanjour, however, was known as a terrible pilot who could not safely fly even a small plane. Third, terrorists brilliant enough to get through the U.S. military's defense system would not have struck the Pentagon's West Wing for many reasons. It had been reinforced, so the damage was less severe than a strike anywhere else would have been. The West Wing was still being renovated, so very few people were there. A strike anywhere else would have killed thousands of people rather than 125. And the Secretary of Defense and all the top brass, whom terrorists who hate America would presumably want to kill, were all safely over in the East Wing. Why would an Al-Qaeda pilot have executed a very difficult maneuver to hit the West Wing at ground level when he could have simply crashed into the roof of the East Wing? Fourth, there is considerable evidence that the aircraft that struck the Pentagon was not even a Boeing 757. For one thing, unlike the strikes on the Twin Towers, the strike on the Pentagon did not create a detectable seismic signal. Also, the kind of damage and debris that would have been produced by the impact of a 757 were not produced by the strike on the Pentagon. According to both photographs and eyewitnesses, former pilot Ralph Olmholt, discussing the photographic evidence, writes, "There is no viable evidence of burning jet fuel. The pre-collapse Pentagon showed no forward-moving damage. There was no particular physical evidence of the expected wreckage. There was no tail, no wings, no damage consistent with a B-757 crash." CNN reporter Jamie McIntyre, reporting live from the Pentagon on 9/11, said, "From my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. Karen Kwiatkowski, who at the time was an Air Force lieutenant colonel working at the Pentagon, has written, "I would think that if a 100-plus ton aircraft going several hundred miles an hour were to hit the Pentagon, it would cause a great deal of possibly superficial but visible damage to the entire area of impact. But I did not see this kind of damage." A fifth problem is that evidence was again destroyed. Shortly after the strike, government agents picked up debris, put it in a large container, and carried it off. Shortly thereafter, the entire lawn was covered with dirt and gravel, so that any remaining forensic evidence was literally covered up. Finally, the videos from security cameras on the nearby Citgo gas station and Sheraton Hotel, which would show what really hit the Pentagon, were immediately confiscated by agents of the FBI. And to this day, the Justice Department has refused to release those. Evidence again appears to have been fabricated. For example, proof that Flight 77 was hijacked and heading back towards Washington was allegedly provided in a phone call from passenger Barbara Olson to her husband, attorney Ted Olson. But no evidence has been provided for the occurrence of this call except the claim of Ted Olson, who works for the Bush-Cheney administration, and who has publicly said it is sometimes okay to lie for the sake of the government. These are only a few of the many reasons, which I have discussed in my books, for concluding that 9/11 was simply one of the latest examples of false flag terrorism. I come now to the main question of this lecture. How should Christians respond to this realization? The key consideration in answering this question, I suggest, is the evidence that the attacks of 9/11 were carried out for the sake of preserving and extending the American empire. This means that there is a two-way relation between 9/11 and this empire. On the one hand, understanding the ideas driving the present phase of the U.S. empire-building project enables us to understand why 9/11 occurred. On the other hand, 9/11 serves as a revelation of the nature of the American empire, an empire that has been in the making on a bipartisan basis for a very long time. 9/11 reveals the nature of the values that have underlay this project for over a century, especially the last 60 years. If so, then we must ask whether the term evil, which U.S. leaders have used so freely to describe other nations, must be applied to our own. There can be no doubt that about the application of this term to 9/11 itself. Here we can quote the president, who on the evening of 9/11 said, "Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. Today our nation saw evil, the very worst of human nature." No explanation of why the attacks were despicable was necessary. This was self-evident. But this proposition is even more self-evident, of course, if the attacks were orchestrated by our own leaders. Accordingly, if we accept 9/11 as a revelation of the American empire, of the basic values it embodies, must we not conclude that this empire is itself evil? This suggestion, of course, runs directly counter to our deeply inculcated self-image, which has embodied the notion of American exceptionalism. According to this view, America is qualitatively different from all other countries, and hence this empire is qualitatively different from all prior empires. Americans in the 19th century said that where other empires were self-seeking, greedy, and brutal, the United States had an empire of liberty, an empire of right. Neoconservatives have recently revived this idea. According to Ben Wattenberg, the American empire is not like earlier European imperialisms. We have sought neither wealth nor territory. Ours is an imperium of values. Robert Kagan calls the United States the benevolent empire. Dinesh D'Souza calls America the most magnanimous imperial power ever. Max Boot says, "America isn't like the empires of old. It does not seek to enslave other peoples and steal their lands. It spreads freedom and opportunity." Charles Krauthammer says that America's claim to be a benign empire is verified by its track record. But many other commentators who base their views on an actual examination of this track record have come to opposite conclusions. Andrew Bacevich, in his book, American Empire, rejects the claim that the promotion of peace, democracy, and human rights, not the pursuit of self-interest, has defined the essence of American diplomacy. Against those who justify American interventions on the ground that America's foreign policy is to promote democracy, Bacevich points out that in previous countries in which America has intervened, democracy did not flower as a result. Many other intellectuals have similar views. Chalmers Johnson, who, like Bacevich, was once a conservative who believed that American foreign policy aimed at promoting freedom and democracy, now describes the United States as a military juggernaut intent on world domination. Richard Falk of Santa Barbara has written of the Bush administration's global domination project, which poses a threat of global fascism. Bacevich sums up the nature of the American empire by employing the statement made in 1939 by the famous historian Charles Beard that America is not to be Rome. In the 1990s, Bacevich says, most Americans still comfort themselves with the belief that as the sole superpower, the United States was nothing like Rome. But, he says, the reality that Beard feared has come to pass. Like it or not, America today is Rome. This comparison is helpful. To begin answering the question of how we should respond to the realization that we live in the new Rome, we can ask how Jesus responded to the original Rome. This question has been treated by New Testament historian Richard Horsley in his book, Jesus and Empire. Horsley's short answer is that Jesus preached an anti-imperial gospel, which called for the reign of Caesar to be replaced by a reign of God. To understand why this would have been central, we need to understand something about Rome and its occupation of Palestine. Rome was not nice. Although Rome's rulers spoke of Pax Romana, with one of its emperors even calling himself the pacifier of the world, this pacification was achieved by means of Rome's overwhelming military might, which it used ruthlessly. As a Caledonian chieftain put it, the Romans butcher, plunder, and call it empire. And where they make desolation, they call it peace. By the time of Jesus, Palestine had been under Roman domination for almost a century. Rome ruled through puppets, first Herod the Great, then Herod Antipas in Galilee, and Pontius Pilate in Judea. And this rule was devastating. Roman legions killed tens of thousands of people and enslaved many more. One traumatic attack was the burning of Sepphoris, only a few miles from Nazareth, near the time of Jesus' birth. Some 2,000 rebels were crucified at about the same time. Besides killing and enslaving the Palestinians, the Romans taxed them severely, pushing many of them permanently into debt. By the time of Jesus, there was a crisis of debt and dispossession that touched and transformed the lives of nearly every peasant family in Galilee. Jesus' anti-imperial gospel is apparent in what we call the Lord's Prayer, which is a modification of the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the establishment of God's kingdom. The central phrase of Jesus' prayer was, therefore, thy kingdom come. An abbreviation of the Kaddish's petition, may God establish his kingdom in your lifetime. That Jesus was not talking about some exclusively otherworldly realm is shown by the next line, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thus, says Horsley, God's activity was political, and Jesus' preaching of that activity was political, with obvious implications for the imperial situation then prevailing in Palestine. The reign of the Roman emperors was to be replaced by the reign of God, which would transform the social, economic, political substance of human relations. The centrality of the economic issue is shown by two other elements in the prayer, the petition for our daily bread and the idea that we should forgive our debtors, an allusion to the fact that unjust and unforgiven debt regularly forced peasants into servitude to rich landlords, as reflected in the parable of the wicked tenants. That Jesus opposed Roman rule even more directly is suggested by evidence that Jesus challenged the payment of the temple tax and the tribute to Rome, and that he protested the temple's system of collecting money. That Jesus was regarded as a rebel against the empire is implied by the very fact that he was crucified. The death penalty could be authorized only by the Romans, and crucifixion was an exclusively Roman means of execution, used primarily for those regarded as challengers to the empire. That Jesus was crucified by the Roman governor, says Horsley, stands as a vivid symbol of his historical relationship with the Roman imperial order. One dimension of the Roman imperial order that particularly offended Jesus and his fellow Jews was Rome's claim that its empire was divinely authorized. Early Christians had a very different view, as shown by the final book of the New Testament, which portrays Rome as a dragon, symbolizing Satan. For the early Christians, Horsley says, Rome was the beast, the harlot, the dragon, the Babylon, the great Satan. They knew that Rome's empire was made possible not by divine order, but by the acquisition of vast territories through the deadly violence of the Roman legions. Is Bacevich right to say that today America is Rome? One way to answer that question is in terms of four commonly accepted features of the Roman Empire. First, it portrayed itself, as we have seen, as divinely guided by providence. Americans have said about the same about their own empire, using the expression manifest destiny. The Christmas card sent out by the Cheneys in 2003 asked rhetorically, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? A second feature, you didn't get that Christmas card? A second feature of the Roman Empire was the development and employment of overwhelming military power. Bacevich, summing up this feature of our own empire, says that the present aim of the U.S. military is to achieve something approaching omnipotence, full spectrum dominance. A third feature of the Roman Empire was rule through puppets, backed up by the empire's pervasive military presence. Some of the most notorious U.S. puppets have been Batista in Cuba, Somoza in Nicaragua, Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier in Haiti, Marcos in the Philippines, Diem in Vietnam, and Suharto in Indonesia. More recently, America has installed a puppet regime in Afghanistan and has been trying to do the same in Iraq. A fourth feature of the Roman Empire was that through its imposition of exorbitant taxes, it impoverished the countries it dominated. America's taxation is more indirect, being exercised through the global economy enforced by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. But it impoverishes just as effectively. An increasing number of commentators have come to speak of global apartheid, thereby pointing to the fact that the world as a whole reflects the same kind of systemic inequality that characterized South Africa under apartheid. Titus Alexander wrote in a 1992 book on this subject, 3/4 of the land in apartheid South Africa and all its natural resources could be owned only by whites, a sixth of the population. The West also has a sixth of the world's population and commands over 3/4 of the global resources. In South Africa, democracy for a few meant oppression for the many. So it is for most people in the global economy. Free trade and consumer choice for a few means low incomes, long hours, and a struggle for subsistence among the many. The only difference between the two systems is that, as Gernot Kurler, who coined the term, put it, global apartheid is even more severe than South African apartheid. What is the relevance of this to the nature of the American empire? This question can be answered in 3 points. First, global apartheid did not exist 3 centuries ago. It is a product of European colonialism. Second, since the end of World War II, when the United States replaced the British Empire as the leader of the global capitalist economy, it has become increasingly responsible for the state of this economy. Third, during this period, the gap between the rich and the poor has become much greater. As theologian John Cobb has pointed out, the disparity in per capita income between the United States and the undeveloped nations is estimated as having been about 13 to 1 in 1947. In 1989, the disparity had reached about 60 to 1. According to the Human Development Report of 2005, the situation is now much worse, with the richest 10% of the world's population receiving 54% of the world's income, and the poorest 40%, meaning 2.5 billion people, receiving only 5% of the total income. The poverty in which billions of God's children live on this earth has dire consequences. Every year, starvation and other poverty-related causes take the lives of about 18 million people, 11 million of whom are children under the age of 5. This means that about 180 million people are dying from poverty-related causes every decade. We have rightly considered the Nazi and Stalinist regimes evil, in large part because each one was responsible for the deaths of some 60 million people. But then what term do we use for an empire that is ultimately responsible for 3 times that many deaths every decade? Part of the reason we call the Nazi and Stalinist regimes evil, of course, is that many of their victims were killed deliberately. Do American leaders realize what they are doing? There is evidence that they do. For example, in 1947, George Kennan, who was director of the policy planning staff in the U.S. State Department, said in a top secret memo, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security." A more recent example showing that our leaders know what they are doing is provided by a 1997 document of the U.S. Space Command called Vision for 2020. This document, explaining why the United States needs to dominate space so as to have full spectrum dominance, says, "The globalization of the world economy will continue with a widening between haves and have-nots." In other words, as the United States and its rich allies become still richer, while the rest of the world becomes still poorer, the United States will need to be able to attack from space to keep the have-nots in line. In 2005, the head of the U.S. Space Command said that by putting weapons in space, the United States will have the ability to destroy anything in the world in 45 minutes. As these parallels between Roman and American imperialism show, we can speak of the latter as evil without even bringing 9/11 into the picture. But the awareness that the attacks of 9/11 were carried out to further America's global domination project and hence increase global apartheid helps us, as I have suggested elsewhere, to fully grasp the extent to which this project is propelled by fanaticism based on a deeply perverted value system. 9/11 can thereby serve as a wake-up call to Christians and Americans, forcing us to ask how to respond to the realization that we are citizens of the new Rome. Any attempt to answer that question would be very long. I will here simply suggest a first step, the formation of an anti-imperial church movement in which the rejection of America's imperial project is considered a necessary implication of Christian faith. Such a movement would be analogous to the movement of confessing Christians formed in Germany in 1934, a year after the Nazis had come to power. This movement, 2 leaders of which were Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, theologians, opposed the movement known as the German Christians, which treated Hitler as a new Messiah who would bring Germany the greatness it deserved. In their famous Barman Declaration, the confessing Christians said that support for National Socialism violated basic principles of Christian faith. One had to choose either Christian faith or National Socialism. One could not affirm both. Later in the century, some Christian bodies decided that the rejection of the system of apartheid in South Africa was a necessary implication of Christian faith. In 1977, the Lutheran World Federation declared that although with regard to most political questions, Christians may have different opinions, the system of apartheid in South Africa was so perverted and oppressive that it constitutes a status confessionis, a confessional situation. The Christian faith, these Lutherans declared, required that churches would publicly and unequivocally reject the existing apartheid system. An analogous question before churches in America today is whether the American empire, with its imperialism and global apartheid, is so perverted and oppressive that the public rejection of it should be regarded as an implication of fidelity to God, as revealed in Jesus of Nazareth, who died on a Roman cross.